I'm here. In this video, I want to ask a very simple question. Are modern minimum wage workers worse off materially than 19th century slaves? And to be clear, I'm talking about black slaves in the United States of America in the 1800s. Now, before we get going, let me ask you a question. You're offered a job as a farmhand working 40 to 50 hours a week. You have no other skills whatsoever. Which offer do you take? $7.25 an hour or $0 plus food and shelter? I asked this question. I ran this poll in four different places. I ran it on Twitter. I ran it on here on YouTube. I ran it on Gab, and I ran it on Telegram. As you can see, many hundreds, thousands of people voted, and the results were pretty much the same on every single site. About a third of the people would take the money, but about two-thirds of the people would take the food and the shelter. Now, before I get into this question, I have to give a couple of little trigger warnings. First, there's one image when I'm discussing slavery that some viewers may find distressing. I'll give you fair warning when that's about to come up, so you can look away if you're squeamish. The second thing is that this video is going to challenge some of your core assumptions, some of those lingering boomer truthisms, and I expect some people are going to get very upset about some of the information I'm going to get into here. But before I start, I want to make it quite clear that the Academic Agent channel complies fully with whatever the British government wants me to say. And also, in case there's any doubt at all, it goes without saying that slavery is bad. Okay, slavery is bad. However, with all of that said, to answer this question, remember the question is, are modern minimum wage workers worse off than 19th century slaves? First, we have to answer another question. What was the reality of life under slavery? What is fact and what is fiction? And the reason I am highlighting some of these things is because I think a lot of people have very prescient images of what slavery was like taken from Hollywood movies. Things like Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained, or the old TV series Roots, or 12 Years a Slave, things like this. But are those depictions that we get in movies accurate? I mean, we know from certain other historical periods that almost nothing that Hollywood tells us is true. So I think it's a fair question to ask, well, how true is the depiction of slavery that we get? The first thing to mention is that slaves were provided with food, clothing, and accommodation. Each family received their own quarters, so they weren't stacked up like sardines in massive dorms. As you can see here, there were these individual cabins, usually run by the mother of the household, and you know that they don't look that bad, some of these slave quarters. I mean, to put it into context, you can say, well, the slave quarters were larger than Butlin's holiday homes, which were holiday residences for British workers, back in the 30s, 40s, 50s. You should still go to them now. I had a check, incidentally, to see how much it is to stay in a Butlin's for a week in 2022. Costs £935, 2 pence. A worker on minimum wage in the UK earns only £380 a week, working 40 hours. And if you have a look at the other housing that was around, like let's say you can compare it to London in the 1890s, where some workers were living in terrible conditions. These gentlemen in the bottom right here, you can see, had to sleep in boxes that look like coffins. Or we can compare it to the USA in the 1930s, for example, where many of the descendants of these slaves lived in objectively worse housing. Or indeed, after World War II, when they erected all of the project, the housing projects, the high rises, as I've pictured there. I mean, if you ask me, the slave quarters were objectively superior housing to some of these others. The very fact that some of those slave quarters are still standing, for example, is testament to how well they were built. And why did slaves have relatively good housing in this way? It seems counterintuitive. Why would people at the lowest rungs of society have better housing than freemen? Well, the simple answer is that they mostly built that housing themselves under the supervision of their master. So, I mean, there's an incentive question there. If you're building your own housing, you're probably going to put some effort into making it as good as possible. And as we'll get on to, the slave masters were typically extremely rich men, so they could afford some decent materials, and you can see the construction on some of these slave quarters is pretty good. Slaves did not go hungry, and first-hand accounts explain that they received, quote, food aplenty. Typically, the mother of each household would provide breakfast and supper, but lunch would be provided centrally as per this account. Weekly food rations, usually cornmeal, lard, some meat, molasses, peas, greens and flour, were distributed every Saturday. Vegetable patches or gardens, if permitted by the owner, supplied fresh produce to add to the rations. Morning meals were prepared and consumed at daybreak in the slaves' cabins. The day's other meals were usually prepared in a central cookhouse by an elderly man or woman no longer capable of strenuous labour in the field. Recalled a former enslaved man, the peas, the beans, the turnips, the potatoes, all seasoned up with meats and sometimes a ham bone, was cooked in a big iron kettle. When meal time come, they all gathered around the pot for a plenty of helpings. And note that most of these sources that I've taken this information from are doing their damnedest. They're actually the academics who put these things together are really trying to make it seem as bad as possible. And yet these are the sorts of quotations that they have to draw from. It seems like you really have to twist the source material in most of these cases to make this situation seem bad. For example, I read the account by Frederick Douglass, and you know, Frederick Douglass is trying to make it seem as bad as possible in his account, because of course he was not politically neutral at that time. And I mean, he just, there's a few little details in there, like for example, he mentions that his mother used to cook on the same fire for the masters as for his own family. And it's like, well, that's kind of interesting to me, that they were both eating from the same, you know, from the same cooking surface, if that makes any sense. Well, anyway, Frederick Douglass claimed that in 1845, food rations were 8 pounds of pork or fish plus 1 bushel of corn meal a month. Well, I had a look to see what corn meal prices and pork prices were. It has to be said, not a lot of money. It cost, bushel of corn meal would cost about 60 cents, 8 pounds of pork, 88 cents. So that's about $23 today, $33, you know, in 2022 money. I will say that shows more than anything else that food was exceptionally cheap in America in the 19th century, especially if you can compare them to, you know, 8 pounds of pork in Joe Biden's America would set you back a hell of a lot more than $33 or 88 cents. So anyway, if you have a look at these rations, they're pretty generous if you think about it, because 1 bushel of cornmeal, I check, can make anywhere between 42 and 90 loaves of bread. And I did have a look to see if these kind of mothers of slave households would turn that cornmeal into bread. And yes, cornbread was a staple of the slave diet, apparently. And then 8 pounds of pork. Well, remember, this is per person. If you work out, that's 4.3 ounces, about 121 grams of pork a day. And remember, as we just read, they got the lunchtime meal separately. They got lunch separate. So these rations were just for that evening meal. Okay, so actually, that's not a bad ration. That's probably more than some people would have gotten during World War, during the 1950s rations in this country and during World War II. They were getting real corn, real pork, not spam and powdered eggs. So, just remember what Thomas Sowell says. What's your basis of comparison? However, archaeological studies have found two extra little details about slave diets. First, remains done by an academic called D.C. Crader suggest that enslaved people and their owners ate similar diets, and that slaves ate good cuts of meat. They've actually done analysis on bones to have a look at the nutrients that were in, that were the slaves malnourished, for example. And they couldn't really find much difference between the slaves and their owners. That's very interesting, I think. Secondly, slaves were supplemented their diet by hunting and fishing. So the diet is more varied than the Douglas account would suggest. Booker T. Washington, for example, he mentions eating chicken in his accounts. Most masters, as we just saw, allowed them to grow their own produce to supplement the rations. So if you have a look at this archaeological work that has been done, it showed that the slave diet was actually quite varied. That, they were eating fish and oysters and deer and rabbits and all sorts of things because, of course, they were living in a very rural area, and nature is abundant. So they would have been able to go off, and do a bit of hunting, wild animals to supplement, what they ate. And you could say, well, oh, isn't it awful that the owners aren't giving them that? But I mean, presumably the owners didn't punish them for doing this, especially as the archaeological findings show that this is actually like a widespread thing, across all of the samples they looked at. So I find that quite interesting. A budget study. Because remember, compared to what? Well, what were workmen living like at this time? Free men, people who just sold their own labor on the free market, didn't have all of these provisions given to them by the slave owner. Well, a budget study in Mississippi in 1875, this was after slavery had been abolished, of course, had a look at 397 workmen's families, and it shows that free workers spent more than half of their wages on food and shelter. More than half. So, and presumably they have to spend the rest of their money on things like clothing and healthcare and all of these other things that were provided to slaves by the owners. Slaves were provided much more than just food and shelter. Here is an account I found. It's an economic historical study from 1905 by Ulrich B. Phillips. He says, aside from the expense of food, clothing, and shelter, the cost of slave labor for any given period of time was made up of several elements. Number one, interest upon the capital invested in the slave. Number two, economic insurance against A, his death, B, his illness or accidental injury, and C, his flight from service. Of course, insurance policies were seldom taken out to cover these risks, but the cost of insurance against them must be reckoned in the cost of slave labor for any given period. So what he's saying there is that in many cases they wouldn't have actually taken insurance out, but this is still a real risk, and those costs, when any of these things happen, are incurred. Okay? And three, the diminishing value of every mature slave by reason of increasing age. Because of the wear and tear of his years and his diminishing prospect of life and usefulness, the average slave of 55 years of age would be worth only half a slave who was 25. Now, before I go on, because he has more points, his footnote here is very interesting. He says, physicians and attorneys' fees should perhaps be included under the head of insurance. It may be noted that doctors' charges were generally the same for slaves as for white persons. To illustrate how expensive this charge often was, we may cite an instance given in the records of Troup County, Georgia, where Dr. Ware collected from Colonel Truett's estate $130.50 for medicine and daily visits to a Negro child from November the 29th, 1858 to January the 5th, 1859. Well, I mean, if you work out, if you adjust that figure for inflation in today's money, that $130 that Colonel Truett gave for the Negro child's medical costs is over $4,600. Medical costs far beyond the average working man of this period. I mean, the average working man wouldn't dream of even earning that amount of money, let alone spending that amount of money for the medical care of their child. It is likely, I mean, I don't know, we don't know any other details, but I mean, given that he was visited daily, one suspects that this child was in, you know, some danger. So it's likely that a free man's child in the same condition would have died, or, you know, not at least not been cured, because they would have been unable to afford the medicine. So that, to me, that seemed like a very significant benefit for the slaves under this system, because, you know, medical costs are very high, or they were very high, and that remains the case today in America, even with Obamacare. So let's carry on. So he says, so he was saying, 55-year-old slave was worth about half as much as a 25-year-old slave because of the depreciation of the of their usefulness. And after 55, the valuation decreased still more rapidly. In computing the cost of any group of slaves, it will be necessary to set over against this depreciation the value of the children born. But on the other hand, the group, the cost by groups would be increased by the need of supporting the disabled Negroes who were not in the working gangs. So, what does this tell us? It tells us that if you were disabled in any way or injured, you would still be looked after, you would still be given food and shelter. And if you retired, if you got too old, they weren't just like put out to pasture or killed off, or they were given a home. You know, as we just saw, they'd give them little jobs like, you know, doling out the food at lunchtime and things like that. So, you know, this is a form of what we'd call today social care that was provided, again, by the owners. And then the fourth major cost, taxation assessed upon the capitalized value of the slaves. In the slaveholding region as a whole, in the later antebellum period, the total assessed value of slave property was at least as great as that of all the other sorts of property combined. So Uncle Sam got his money as well through taxation. Now, it's worth remembering, like, you may be thinking this is an awful lot of outlays for the slave owners here. But you have to remember that the slave owners were, again, contrary to a lot of stuff that you'll read in the mainstream media, typically very wealthy people. They would have been the equivalent to billionaires or multimillionaires today. I've had a look at distribution tables. I'm not going to bother going into the detail here, but you can see that the richest people in the South were richer than the richest people in the North. Okay, the very top of the pyramid, they were richer in the South than they were in the North. Okay, the plantation owners were richer than the industrialists, certainly in this period here up until, by 1861. Remember, most people in the South, and I'm talking about white people here in the South, over 75% did not own slaves. It was only a moneyed elite who could afford them. The bottom 50% of those slave owners had between one and four slaves only. The slave owners who owned more than 100 slaves accounted for around 0.11% of the population. But in effect, this meant that the owners, remember then, the vast majority of the owners, if you were working on a farm with more than 10 people, say, if you're on a plantation with more than 10 slaves on it, your owner was probably a pretty wealthy person by the standards of that day, which means they could afford things like doctor's fees, decent materials, you know, good rations, things like that. So the fact that these people were rich, you could say, well, isn't that awful? Isn't that exploitative? Yes, but on this, you know, there is a plus side to that. You know, I mean, just think of it today. If you were, you know, would you rather have somebody like Elon Musk as a master, or would you rather have like Joe Bloggs down the road? Well, you know that even if Elon Musk is scrimping, his scrimping is still more, is going to, just by virtue of the fact that he's got a shitload of money, you know, you're going to get more working for Musk than you are from the bloke down the street. Okay. Now, I was actually quite shocked to see certain mainstream media outlets like the Washington Post actually trying to, also the Washington Times, the one that Jeff Bezos owns, actually trying to dispute this, these numbers here. But I don't know how they can dispute them, because we actually have the exact numbers of how many slave owners there were and how many slaves they owned, and then the total population. So this is hard data. It cannot be disputed. I've seen some, you know, newspapers try to argue that as many as 40% of people own slaves. Well, that's impossible. It's just impossible. We know that the cost of each slave was very, very high. You know, far outside the capabilities of most normal people to be able to afford one. You know, we're talking about thousands and thousands of pounds here. Can you just afford 37 grand to spend on? You can't afford it. So just like today, where people have like Eastern European au pairs and home help and servants and things like that, well, it's only very wealthy people who can afford that. So that's worth bearing in mind as well. Now, friends, for the squeamish among you, as promised, I would give you a heads up. There is going to be a picture of a man who has lacerations on his back in the following slide. Okay, so if you want to look away now. What about the cruelty of slavery, though? You know, this picture I've been giving you so far, you know, you'd think, well, this is all hunky-dory, but, you know, weren't these people whipped every day? It is worth asking a few questions rather than remembering what you have seen in Hollywood movies. So, you know, if you were to look at the average Hollywood movie, you'd think that slaves were whipped pretty much every day, or, you know, is a very common occurrence. But what do historical studies tell us? If we ask a simple question, how often were slaves whipped? What was the answer? Well, to get into that, let's do a little bit of incentive analysis and a bit of just basic economics, shall we? Here's another question before we even get to that question. Would you abuse someone, or even something, that you had spent thousands of dollars on? Slaves were very expensive, with skilled ones worth over $1,000, which is the equivalent of $37,000 in today's money. And some, such as blacksmiths, were worth more than twice that amount. Okay, if you spent $37,000 on a car, here's a question. Would you take a stick and beat that car? And now imagine that it's not a car, but it's a human being. So that is a rhetorical question, but it's just something, it's a very simple little heuristic that people just never consider when they think about this. The Hollywood depiction of slavery is not only sensationalized, but also almost entirely inaccurate. A much more accurate picture of what went on slave plantations and what life was like can be gathered by reading slave narratives collected by the Library of Congress in the 1930s. And I will get on to what some of them say in a moment. First of all, though, just to underline the point of the expense of a slave, here is the real price of purchasing a slave in 2020 US dollars over time. And as you can see there, for a lot of the time, it was very expensive. In 1850, for example, which is said by analysts to be the most representative year, it's like the median year across all of these, the most expensive slave sold fetched $240,000. That's in 2020 money. And the cheapest slave sold in that year was $14,000. So this is not chump change, okay? This is money that would have been beyond the vast majority of people, as we've already talked about. Again, if you're squeamish, look away now, because I'm going to be sharing that same famous picture and talking about it now. So what's the answer? How many times were slaves whipped in the US? And turns out the internet was pretty helpful here. The site Quora, somebody had asked this question, how often were slaves in the US whipped? I mean, again, it's obvious why we're asking this question, because in every depiction you see in Hollywood, there's a lot of whipping. Well, here's the answer. 95% or more of slaves were never whipped in their lifetime. The famous image that you see here, and I can guarantee that you'd have seen this image or some variation on it at some point in your education, or you've just seen it on TV, HBO documentary, whatever. Now, this was taken in 1863, and it was taken of a man called Gordon, and it was used as Union war propaganda. Now, Gordon was an ex-slave who joined the war effort on the Union side and who was then captured and beaten by the Confederates before he escaped back to the Union side. And this picture that you've taken, that you see here, was taken after he had received that beating from the Confederates, who basically found, you know, they were at war, these people. So this was like a military-style punishment that was given to him. Extremely rare on a slave plantation, but, you know, this is what happened during the war. The Union then used this photo under the banner, quote, a typical Negro, quote, and they used it as propaganda. It was a wartime propaganda, and that's how you have to see this image, okay? Flogging was used as a punishment, not just for slaves, but also for non-slaves, not just for black people, but also for white people. And they used flogging as an alternative to incarceration. It was a behavior modification tool and a punishment for crime. Okay, you wouldn't be flogged if you disobeyed somebody on a slave plantation. You were flogged if you were guilty of some crime or other. Okay, theft, murder, rape, or whatever it happened to be. I mean, you'd probably get worse for murder and rape, to be fair, but they use flogging as not to lock people up in prison for lengthy periods of time. Okay, so the depiction of using whipping as a method of keeping slaves in line on plantations, which we commonly see in films today, is actually ahistorical. It's wrong. Flogging was a criminal punishment. You have to see it in those terms. Okay, so that is the truth about the whipping element. Again, remember, I'm not saying slavery was good in this video. I'm just correcting the historical record to gain an accurate picture of what life was like. And, you know, the truth is, just as today, how most people haven't been to jail, well, you have to see flogging in those terms. Well, most people, just as most people have never been to jail or prison, most people would have never been flogged. because it was a criminal punishment. How about cases of rape? That's also prescient and, blown up by the media today. Well, estimates of children fathered by white men on slave plantations average at fewer than 2%. The number of women who said they had been raped in the 1930s Library of Congress interviews was 1.2%. Even if you account for the fact that there would have been some people who wouldn't have wanted to talk about it, the most severe estimates put that number at 8%. Okay, so even extremely hardcore kind of activist type scholars still only put the number of rapes at 8%. Okay, now to put that in context, what's the normal number of rapes in a society even without slavery? Okay. And many statistical studies today claim that over 15% of women in the modern USA have been raped or sexually assaulted. And therefore, we can say, using statistics put out by so-called woke modern scholars, okay, we can say that a woman would be less likely to be raped on a slave plantation in 1850 than on the campus at Harvard in 2022. That's their own statistics. What about slave revolts, though? Well, between 1521 and 1859, there were only 30 slave revolts in North America. I think the slave revolts were much bigger in the imagination because of what happened in Haiti, to be honest. I mean, I've read accounts by Thomas Carlyle and people like George Fitzhugh of this period, and it was really that what happened in Haiti that was prescient in everybody else's mind. Actually, in North America, there were very few revolts. To put this in perspective, between 1880 and 1890, there were over 20,000 industrial strikes in the USA. That is, so-called free workers on the free market striking against their employers for fairer pay or whatever else. Now, Revealed Preference shows that slaves were objectively more content than free workers if revolts and strikes are taken as markers of discontent. I mean, you cannot argue with those figures. They're barely comparable. In addition, we know that many former slaves returned to the same plantations they had left, working for the same owners, and even lived in the same quarters. These pictures you can see here were taken, the one on the left, the one on the right was taken in South Carolina in 1863, and the one on the left here was taken in Mississippi in 1937. The difference was that now they did not receive food, shelter, and clothing, and they were paid typically about $1 a day. So from the point of view of these workers who went back to those same plantations, slavery was objectively a better deal for them. Objectively. And one of the things that modern scholars do not like to admit, or they try to explain away, is that you have met older men and women in the 1930s in many of these Library of Congress accounts saying that they had it better under slavery than they have it under so-called freedom. Okay, so I'm not arguing with the slave accounts. I mean, you have to kind of start psychologizing and contextualizing and explaining this away, but there are so many of them saying the same sort of thing that it really seems like copes from the modern scholars, if I'm honest. What about escape attempts then? We're always told by libertarian economists, the reason that slavery was not efficient and was non-profitable and so on was because they kept on escaping and you had to use time and resources to thwart those escape attempts. Well, the data shows pretty clearly. Can have a look at this. These tables are actually from someone who was trying to make this point about escapes, and I was like, well, if you have a look at the total numbers of enslaved on the bottom right table there, and you look at the escapes per year in the top table there, you can see that in any given year, only around 0.09% of the slave population escaped. Which is a tiny number, absolutely tiny amount of people. To put that in perspective, 0.7% of the US population today are incarcerated, you know, in prison. This means that a person today is more than 8 times likely to commit a crime and get caught than a slave in 1850 was likely to escape. And that's for the whole US population there. I know, for example, that of that 0.7% of US population are incarcerated, 40% of those people are black. The sums are too complicated for me to work out, but it's probably many more times than 8 times likely to commit crime and be put in prison if you're black in the USA in 2022 than if you're white. Also, just to account for some of the rising number of free men, it's like, well, if they weren't escaping, how are they? Why was the figure of free black men rising? Well, one of the reasons is that slaves could buy their own freedom. The cost was variable, but it wasn't cheap. It was anywhere between $500 and $1,000. That was in their money then. We've already seen $1,000 is equivalent of about 37 grand today. You know, quite a lot of money. It is known that by 1839, around 42% of free blacks in Cleveland, Ohio, had bought back their freedom. Now, how you may be thinking, well, how could slaves possibly afford to do this when they were not paid? Well, many masters allowed slaves to work for others in their spare time. Or sometimes they just hire them out. They just be like, well, in exchange for a certain fee, you can have my man here for the next month or the next 3 months or whatever. You pay me a certain amount, you know, to compensate me for what I paid for him. But also, you pay him as well. And the rates that these slaves who did these outside jobs got were pretty good. And so those slaves who had this opportunity often took it. But you have to be realistic here. It's not like this was an opportunity available to all of them due to the high prices. It was typically the most skilled slaves, such as, remember, blacksmiths, or if they were women, the seamstresses and the tailors. They would typically cost around 50%, 55% more than the going rate, the average going rate of other slaves. Remember, we saw in 1850 the most expensive slave in that year was $240,000 in our money, in 2020 money. So if you adjust that down, I mean, it's something like $6,500 in 1850 money. I mean, that's a hell of a lot of money in 1850. $6,500. So you can imagine, if you're a slave owner and you've shelled out all that money for this guy, you're not going to just want to set him free after spending all of that. And that is why the likes of these skilled slaves had to give some compensation to purchase their freedom. And of course, it made sense for some of these skilled slaves to do this, because when they became free, they'd have a realistic chance of making a good living as a freeman due to being literally in demand. And it would have made sense. I mean, if you were a slave who was able to earn money by doing outside jobs, it stands to reason that there was already market demand for you, okay? Especially if you're reaching, 6.5k on the free market, as your going rate. So it was more realistic for them than for the typical field hand. So I thought it was worth going into that a little bit, because I don't want to give you the idea that, slaves were buying their freedom willy-nilly. This was a kind of elite band of slaves who had special skills who then could have made a good living, on the open market. As we've looked at already, some of those field hands actually fared a lot worse. You know, their going rate on the free market was a dollar a day. You know, and if you're on a dollar a day, you are not buying back your freedom for $500. And another question I might very briefly touch on is, why were the prices for the slaves so astronomically high? Simply put, and contrary to free market dogma, slaves were profitable. Okay, this graph that I am showing you here shows net labor income per capita. Okay, that is, when you take away all the other costs, the food, the shelter, the medical care, all those taxes and stuff, if you take all that stuff away, how much money does each slave bring in? And you can see each slave is bringing in well over 100 grand, in some cases almost 200 grand, okay? That is pretty productive and pretty profitable. So, and then when you work it all out, it's definitely worth the investment if you're one of these very wealthy plantation owners. The dip that you can see here, you can see that the line goes down a little bit from 1836, 1837 to about the mid-1840s, and then it starts picking back up again. That is just a normal wider economic downturn following the panic of 1837, which was just your regular boom-bust financial crash. You know, if you know your business cycles, these things happen all the time. It was like 2008 crash, or, you know, dot-com burst, or whatever else. It was one of those, but a big one. Panic of 1837. So, of course, that's going to affect the whole economy, including the slave economy. It's not going to be immune to market shocks of that kind. But that doesn't show that slavery was not profitable, even in the very lowest point of that crash. If you can see in, let's say, 1844, still over 80 grand a head income from each slave, and by the time of the Civil War, that had more than doubled. So slavery was not ended by economics. Slavery was ended by war and by government fiat and by the stroke of Abraham Lincoln's pen. It was not ended because it didn't work and it was inefficient. Okay. There was an overall shift in the US economy, in the balance of the economy, from the South to the North. But that wasn't anything to do with slavery. That was to do with industrialism and the shift from agriculture to industry, okay, to manufacturing. But that happened everywhere, whether they had slavery or not, okay? And, I mean, it's obvious. I wrote a whole book about free market economics called The Defenders of Liberty. And I talk about, well, what happened in Britain when they repealed the corn laws and they allowed corn to be sold from elsewhere? Well, a lot of the British agriculture at that time, and we're talking in exactly this period, the 1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s, okay, got completely wiped out. Why did it get wiped out? Well, partly it was the shift to heavy industry and manufacturing, and a lot of those rural field hands went on to be industrial working class. They went to the cities, they went to urban areas to work in factories. But it's not just that. It is because the local agriculture could not compete with American prices. The British Industrial Revolution was fueled by cheap American wheat, cheap American grain. Where were they getting the food from? Cheap American cotton. Where were they getting this stuff from? They were getting it from slave plantations. How was the American agricultural sector more competitive than the British one, who didn't have slavery? Don't forget. I mean, it stands to reason. I mean, yes, you could say, well, America's got a lot more land and so on and so forth, so it's going to have, it's going to be able to produce more and lower the costs, economies of scale, yes. But it's just obvious you're not paying the workforce. You know, once you've built the housing, they produce most of the food in-house, as we saw. You know, I mean, these are big rural areas that could produce things like food, and they've got enough land so they could build their own shelter. Well, once you've paid for all those costs, you know, it's going to produce a lot of goods for you, and you can sell those goods and make a lot of money. So it was profitable, and it was objectively more profitable than non-slave farming in Britain, which fell to pieces in the 1800s. So there's just no argument there, as far as I can see, if you look at the raw data. Libertarians like to put this line out because, you know, it's their one big virtue signal that they're against slavery, and the free market shows that slavery was inefficient, but it's just not true. Just not true, I'm afraid. So now let's fast forward to 2022, and we will ask, well, how does the modern minimum wage worker compare? Average weekly rent for a one-bedroom apartment in the USA is around $275, okay, a week. That is based on the average of $1,080 a month. Okay, that's the average for the whole of the USA. Now, I did, just out of interest, go and have a look to see if I could find a one-bedroom apartment of any, you know, worth living in for that amount of money. I looked in Texas. I looked in San Francisco. I looked in Virginia. And I looked in Oklahoma City. And I honestly could not find an apartment that was actually that cheap. In San Francisco, the price was more than four times as high as that. In Texas, it was about twice as high as that. Oklahoma was the closest I could find, Oklahoma City. But even there, the prices were not... were a little bit higher than the average, okay? So, now obviously, if you go out into the rural sticks, you could find cheaper apartments, I imagine. But then you've got the problem is, well, where are you going to find a minimum wage job in the middle of bloody nowhere? So, you know, in order to get the minimum wage job, you need to be in a relatively developed area, kind of an urban area. But then in those urban areas, the prices are actually higher than the average. So this average figure, you could say, well, it's misleading one way or the other. But it's actually like, well, you know, there's not a lot of work in rural areas. There's just not a lot of work in. It's just the truth. Most of those farmhand jobs have been mechanized. They've been automated out of existence at this point. It was the combine harvester who replaced the slave, ultimately. Anyway, the average food bill is $105 a week. And they do pretty robust stats on this. Now, the federal minimum wage in the US is $7.25, and that's working. So if you worked 40 hours a week, you'd make $290 on the federal minimum wage. And looking at those figures, slavery was objectively a better deal. Now, of course, people will be quick to point out that in reality, almost nobody makes minimum wage. It's much more likely that you'd be earning something like $15 an hour, okay? But if you do the calculations, to afford average food and shelter, okay, just to cover the costs, and this is at those rates I just talked about, so $750 a week on rent, $100 or so a week on food, just to cover that, you'd need to earn $9.50 an hour, okay? And that's having, so if you were $9.50 an hour, you'd have zero money left over after paying food and rent, okay? Now, considering, as we looked at, slaves were provided with amenities, all of their bills paid, clothing, healthcare, retirement care, the equivalent modern wage would need to be closer to something like $30 an hour to get the equivalent in services that those slaves were receiving from their slave owners. And that's without even considering taxes, okay? And nobody on minimum wage is earning $30 an hour, okay? Your McDonald's worker, at most, he's going to be on $20 an hour. This chap here who's stacking the shelves in Walmart or whatever this is, he's not going to be on $30 an hour, okay? So that is something to ponder. It seems to me that if you look purely at the material circumstances, the slave in the 19th century was in fact better off than the modern worker. Of course, there are non-economic factors. A lot of people will be screaming at the screen, what about freedom, academic agent? Well, I mean, if you think working for $9.50 an hour to have zero disposable income at the end of the month is freedom, then, you could say it's just slavery under a different name, couldn't you? You could say that. And there are non-economic benefits to those plantations that I didn't get into, like the fact that these people would have been plugged into a big community. They all would have known each other. If you remember, if we had a look on that distribution, most of the plantations were 100 people or less. OK, well, that's below Dunbar's number. So they actually had probably quite a nice community life there. They all knew each other, you know, as we saw, the households were in family units, you know, so they would have grown up with their mother and their father. Of course, some slave families were broken up if, let's say the brother was sold off or something like that. And obviously that's heartbreaking. But in many cases, the families were left intact because if you think about it, if you've bought a slave and you then have a child, well, as we saw, it's actually a lot more profitable to keep hold of that child into adulthood. You're essentially getting a new hand for nothing, who could produce 80, 100, 200 grand for you. That's a lot of money. So there was an incentive to, keep those families together. Also, of course, these people are human and they would have been in daily contact. Like, imagine looking someone in the face and saying, well, you know, I'm going to send your mother away or whatever. I mean, I'm not trying to say it didn't happen, but a lot of the accounts I saw, including those of Booker T. Washington and of Frederick Douglass, had intact families. And actually, they were plugged into these wider community networks in a way that most people in 2022 are not. They just simply aren't. Of course, there were other drawbacks. I mean, the lack of freedom of movement would be a big one that people would point to. And of course, I'm not just at all saying that slavery is good in this video, not at all. But I am suggesting that in many respects, it is superior to being that bottom rung worker in today's system. In fact, so dire are the numbers today for the low paid worker. I wonder how many of that 0.7% of incarcerated folk simply choose to stay in prison because they get food and shelter and, you know, they don't have to worry about anything. They get all of their basics covered. You have to wonder how many people are in prison kind of out of choice. If the pandemic showed anything at all, lots of people tend to value security over freedom. I know freedom is the big meme in America, you know, this is the land of freedom and so on. But in reality, when push comes to shove, most people did not object to being locked up in their house for 2 years during the pandemic. And as we saw in the polls at the start, about two-thirds of people would take the guaranteed security of the food and shelter over the insecurity of a wage and a job from which you could be fired willy-nilly. All right, I'm sure this video is going to spark a lot of debate. I look forward to reading some of the comments. I expect some pushback from libertarians and from people who don't want to look at some of these truths about slavery that I was talking about, but that's fine. I'm aware this is a controversial area, and again, I will stress again, I'm not trying to say that slavery was good. I am merely trying to highlight that the deal they had, when you compare it to the deal that the modern minimum wage worker gets, was objectively not as bad in material terms. All right, buy all my courses, join the channel, buy a mug, but most importantly of all, get out.
If you like Academic Agents content on this channel, sign up for a course on the Academic Agency. He's now offering Foundations of Economics. Click the link in the show description and level up your econ knowledge.
Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.